that. So today's lecture is not really part of the statistical mechanics course, although as we will see, we'll calculate some partition function in a sneaky way, and we will derive some interesting and important properties of black holes from that partition function. Okay, so this is a bonus lecture. It's not examinable. And so the aim is to really have fun. So let me start with something you very well know, and that's the Schwarzschild metric. And so we will actually look at this metric, and we will calculate some important characteristics of this metric. And then we will observe that actually these characteristics obey something like a nice relation. So part A, motivation. And so let us start with the Schwarzschild metric. And you know that the metric is simply given, it's a spherically symmetric spacetime, the most general one if you consider vacuum, and if you consider, Okay, so it's minus f dt square plus dr square over f plus r square d omega square, where this function f is simply given by 1 minus 2m over r, and d omega square is just the element on the sphere. So it's d theta square plus sine square theta d phi square. Okay. So this is the Schwarzschild metric as you've seen it in your relativity course. And so you used it to study some interesting things like Mercury perihelion shift and stuff like that, or the bending of light near the sun. But let me now look at its characteristic properties. And so one of them is the asymptotic mass. So now, in general relativity, in general, it's very problematic to define energy. And so gravity actually behaves holographically. It means that you cannot define the energy locally, but you can only say what is the energy inside some volume of space. And so for this reason, we don't talk about a local mass or anything, but we talk about the asymptotic mass, where we say we enclose the whole spacetime by some sphere, and then calculate how much mass is inside this spacetime. So now, of course, mass, we know that it's something like energy. So this is like a total energy. And you know that the energy better be associated with something where there is like a time translation symmetry or whatever through the Noether's theorem. Okay, so now I'll spend 5 minutes explaining something which is obvious to everybody, that M is actually the total energy of the Schwarzschild spacetime. Okay, so the M which you see here is really what we are after, but we know that by Noether's theorem, if there is a symmetry, then there must be the corresponding conserved quantity. And in particular, if the symmetry is something like time translation symmetry, then this conserved quantity will be something like the mass of the spacetime. Okay, so now you know that the symmetries in general relativity, you had a beautiful tutorial on that with Gong, and then you discuss it later, is that the symmetries in GR are described by Kinning vectors. So symmetries in GR correspond to the symmetries of the metric, and so these are given by Kinning vectors. And the Kinning vector is simply a vector field in the spacetime, and what you are really after is that as you move along this Kinning vector field and compare whatever you had before with whatever you see around the direction now, actually it doesn't change. And so that results in an equation that the lead derivative of the metric is equal to zero, which
translates into the Killing equation, nabla nu xi mu, nabla mu xi nu equals to zero.
So that's your Killing vector equation, and it basically tells you, yeah, there is a symmetry of the metric. So specifically,
Schwarzschild spacetime, Schwarzschild is static. So nothing depends on time here.
If you look at the metric, you immediately see that from the fact that there's no time dependence in the metric functions. And so it is static. So there is a corresponding Killing vector,
which you can write as d over dt Killing vector.
This is my vector, which satisfies this Killing equation here. Okay. So now there is no surprise that we have a symmetry described by this Killing vector. So that must be the corresponding conserved quantity. The question is how to calculate this conserved quantity. And so, as I said, there's many definitions of mass, and there's many definitions, and there's many prescriptions how to calculate mass in general relativity. But perhaps the simplest one, if you have static spacetime, is the Komar mass, which really calculates this M. So now, this is calculated as M is equal to minus 1 over 8 pi, some annoying prefactor here. And then you integrate over the sphere at infinity. And what you integrate is the following quantity here. So this is your Killing vector, which has to somehow enter the prescription of your formula. It's a vector. Of course, what you have to do is that you lower the index, so you consider k mu with index down. Now you have a one form, right? So now you take the exterior derivative of that, which gives you a two form, okay? And now you make a Hodge dual of that, which is again a two form. So now this is a two form, which you integrate over a two manifold, which you integrate over the sphere S2. So you can always integrate, you know, p forms over a p manifold, and this is precisely what you get. So anyway, so this is the prescription. Prescription. If you have a Killing vector, which has to do with time, this will be the conserved charge here. And if you calculate this thing here, of course, what you find that indeed it equals to m. So really, this m which enters here is the total mass, as defined by the Noether's charge. Okay, so now this was much ado about nothing. Everybody knew that this is M. But anyway, so we have now nice proof that indeed this is true. Okay, so that's one property. Another property, you studied a little bit the black hole horizon. And so you said, so you observed that actually my metric is not well defined everywhere. And in fact, when r is equal to 2m, so r plus equals to 2m, and something bad happens and your coordinates break down. But as you've seen in the relativity course, it's actually just a coordinate problem. There is no singularity or anything. So if you change coordinates, you can actually go through this. But of course, this thing here is a quite important property because the coordinates as written here are the coordinates associated with the asymptotic observer. So with an observer who is very, very far away from the black hole. And so this observer actually will see something strange happening at r equals to 2m. Okay, so this is really, if you want, a boundary of the black hole. And so one way to see this is really to look at, again, you had a nice tutorial about this, about the gravitational redshift. And so you may be asking a question. So this is my r equals to 2m. So this is r equals to 2m. And then you have an observer who is sitting somewhere at some different r. So let's say at a radius r. And so now you may be sending a signal, which you send it from the horizon to the observer. And the question is how the observer actually sees that signal. Okay. So you may be asking this. And so now repeating the same argument as you had in your tutorial. So you know that the surface gravity, well, you know that the frequency here and the frequency there is just 1 over the proper time here and there. So frequency at the distance r divided by frequency at r plus is delta tau at r plus divided by delta tau at r. And so using this metric, of course, you are sending the radial photon. So d omega squared is equal to 0. Okay, so you have that. And so this is equal to f at r plus divided by f at r. And of course, you have delta t here, and then you have delta t here. Okay, and so the delta t is the same, so it doesn't contribute. But now, of course, what you see that f of r plus is precisely how you define that it's actually 0. So that's how you found it. So this is equal to 0. So in other words, if you send a signal from the horizon to anywhere in the space, actually you observe a 0 frequency. So this is actually a surface, if you want, of infinite redshift, because whatever you send to the outer observer, that observer will never see it. So this boundary of the black hole, so r plus, is a surface of infinite redshift. And if you want, because you know whatever you send from there, you know, never reaches the observer outside. This is precisely the definition of why black hole is black, right? So you never observe anything. So this is why. Why is this called a black hole? So by the way, originally actually people came with different names than black hole. So this is the term coined by Wheeler. But originally, for example, in Russia, people call it like frozen stars, because whatever you throw inside the black hole, if you start observing this, what's happening with that object, the object actually slowing down, redshifting, and it actually freezes on the horizon and it never crosses the horizon for the external observer. So people call them, you know, frozen stars, but black hole is, of course, nicer. Yeah, this is basically the reason why people call it black hole. Okay, very good. So we have the boundary of the black hole situated at r plus equals 2m. And then you may be asking, you know, what is the area of the black hole? So surface area well, and the answer is, of course, it's pi r plus square. So a is pi r plus square. And so the reason for this is that actually when you were deriving the Schwarzschild metric, you have chosen a so-called area gauge. So you have chosen such a radial coordinate so that at given r, the areas are always pi r square. OK, so this is a reason because of the area gauge for. So you choose your radial coordinate r in such a way that at a given r, the surface of the sphere is as if you were in flat space. Of course, mathematically, how you can see this is that you take this metric, and so you know that on the horizon, you have dt equals to dr equals to 0. So then your induced metric out of this, you just plug it there. You have d gamma square is just r plus square d omega square. It's your induced metric on the horizon. Horizon. And there is a beautiful thing, is how you calculate the areas of the induced matrix. And so the area is simply an integral over that over the determinant of gamma, and so the theta d phi. Okay, so this is, by the way, nothing else than you will see. So for particle, we are doing the same thing. So remember, you're calculating how long is the trajectory swept by the particle. And it's given, if you want, by the determinant of the induced metric for the particle. The induced metric is dx mu, dx nu, g mu nu over d tau square. And so this is precisely that, and d tau. Or in string theory, you will see that this is, you will call this Namugoto action. And so you will calculate how, you know, what is the area swept by string. And again, it's just square root of determinant of the induced metric there. So anyway, you can prove this geometrically. So but for us, determinant of this metric is a 2 by 2 metric. And so you have r plus square times r plus square, but you have also sine square theta. And so this is, if you take the square root of that, it's r plus square sine theta d theta d phi. And you integrate this over theta and phi. And of course, it's like on the standard sphere. So you get just 4 pi r squared. So I'm missing 4. 4 pi r plus square. Sorry for that. Of course, it's 4 pi. Are there any questions to this? So this is how big the black hole is. What is the surface area of that black hole? OK, so far so easy. So now comes a more complicated concept, which fortunately is the last one we need really to understand black hole thermodynamics. And that is of the surface gravity. And so the best physical intuition for that is that you may be asking, what is the force I have to actually hold a particle to stay on the horizon? OK, so let's say this is my black hole. And then there's a particle here. And I want to hold it so that it doesn't fall into the black hole. Of course, the particle wants to fall there because there's some gravitational force. Let's call that force, well, so there's some gravitational force. And so to hold it there so that it doesn't fall there, to hold it at fixed r, you may be asking, what is that force? And so what do you think is that force if you are on the horizon? So if the particle is here, what do you think that force is?
Infinity.
Exactly. Because otherwise, you could actually escape from the black hole, right? So if the force were finite, actually, I could, you know, switch on my engine or whatever, and I could escape from the black hole. So on the horizon, such a force is actually infinite. So this is not good. But you know that we have this redshift, and of course, as you go to as you go outside of the horizon, this redshift is actually infinite as well. And so if you go further and further away, so now your observer is actually here. The force diminishes. So now the observer is clever. He has some kind of string here, and he holds that particle there. But now if you are actually away from that horizon, because of this infinite redshift, the force suddenly becomes finite. So an observer holding, so at infinity, can hold a particle on the horizon through, you know, using this string or whatever, using a massless string. And this can be done with a finite force. And so the finite is really because you are balancing whatever the infinity I have to hold it here with the infinite redshift here, and so that's why actually the force can be finite. Okay. So now, of course, you don't want the force, but you want something like a gravitational acceleration, and you know that for the force is m times a. So if I choose actually this particle of the mass m equals to 1, then this will define that force will be equal to my gravitational acceleration as perceived by the observer at infinity. Okay, so kappa, which is the surface gravity corresponds to acceleration ration. So if you want, we are setting the mass of the test particle here on the horizon equal to 1, and then it is the force I have to apply at infinity to hold the particle at infinity. Okay, so this is the idea of kappa. Very good. So now what you can show is that this kappa here for a spherical symmetric spacetime. So this is the physical meaning of kappa. So really, you know, how much force I have to apply to hold the particle at infinity on the horizon. And so this is like a gravitational acceleration of the particle on the horizon, however, as perceived at infinity. Okay. And so now there's a formal definition which is not interesting. But it turns out that if you use that formal definition, that you find this beautiful simple formula. So you take, for any spherical symmetric spacetime, you take the function f, and then you take the derivative with respect to r, and you plug r plus, and this is your formula. So now, what is that? So our f is 1 minus 2m over r. So we have to differentiate over r, 1 minus 2m over r. And then we have to plug r equals to r plus, and then we have to divide by 2. And hopefully this is equal to 1 over 4m, or 1 over 2r plus, if you do that calculation. Okay, so this is really the gravitational acceleration on the horizon, which is somehow very normalized, if you want. So now, does this make sense? Is it actually simple or not? So there's an interesting observation, and that observation is, well, let's just use Newton's gravity. And so we know that in Newton's gravity, the gravitational acceleration is simply given by m over r squared. Okay, so observation, this is in Newton. Okay, so now we want to evaluate that on the horizon. So at r equals to r plus. So we have m divided by r plus square. But remember that r plus square is just 2m square. Okay, so this is 1 over 4m. So actually, if you use the Newtonian theory, then these two results would coincide. Of course, the interpretation is slightly different. But you, even using the Newtonian theory, and you were calculating what is the, you know, gravitational acceleration at a surface at radius r plus, you would get the same result. Okay, so just a coincidence, of course. Well, this is not generally true, but spherically symmetric spacetimes are basically almost Newtonian. So actually, if you use Newtonian theory, you almost get the right result. okay, very good. So now we have everything we need. We introduced the concept of the mass, which is over there, m. We have the concept of the surface area of the black hole, and we have the concept of the surface gravity. So now an observation
So we have that A is 4 pi r plus square, and then M is r plus over 2, and kappa is 1 over 2 r plus. And so
once you have this, you may have a stupid or great idea to play with some differentials. And so what you will find is that the M, if you differentiate with respect to r plus, is actually kappa over 2 pi times dA over 4. OK, so try it if you don't believe it. But this is an interesting observation. And so this is the beginning of black hole thermodynamics. OK, so you can check it as a homework. Very good. So are there any questions so far? So far, everything is easy, right? So the only really new thing, I think, for you, maybe the surface gravity. But really, think about it like a gravitational acceleration on the horizon of the black hole, which is renormalized to infinity. OK, otherwise, it would be infinite. But I want to measure it at infinity rather than on the horizon. And so because of the redshift, this is actually becoming finite now. OK, very good. So now this was the origin of black hole mechanics. So part B will be black hole mechanics. And this is basically 1973. So you know, or maybe you don't know, but you probably expect that Schwarzschild is not the only black hole you can have. But you can have slightly more complicated black holes. And these black holes typically can include like charge and rotation and stuff like that. OK, so there's these three gentlemen, Bardeen, Hawking, and Carter. So they consider basically the most general black hole, if you want. So for the most general black hole, and what I mean by this is that it doesn't only have mass, this mass m, but that is also, you know, it can rotate, rotation J, so that's the corresponding angular momentum. And it can also have charge Q. It can also have magnetic charge, if you believe in those. But let's not consider that. Okay. So in fact, there is something like Noether theorem, which tells you, well, actually, this is everything I can have. I can only have mass, rotation, and charge. I cannot have anything weirder than that. For example, I cannot have a scalar field around the black hole, because the scalar field would either actually go to infinity and radiate away, or it would actually collapse onto the black hole, be swallowed by the black hole, and there wouldn't be any trace of it. Okay, so for example, I cannot have a scalar field, scalar hair, which would be another charge which would be characterizing the black hole. So anyway, so we have that. Before the most general black hole, we have the following laws. And so there is a Zero's law, which reads that the surface gravity, if you calculate it for this black hole, is actually a constant on the horizon. OK, so that's the Zero's law. So all these laws were proved by these gentlemen purely using geometric arguments. So for a general black hole, they just calculate the surface gravity. That is, you know, it's all is classical and all is just geometry. So now then there is a first law, which tells you that dm is equal to kappa over 2 pi dA over 4. That's what we had before. But now we can also have work terms. So plus phi dq, which are the work terms. So your black hole can have angular momentum j. And the thermodynamically conjugate quantity to that is like an angular velocity. So this would be the angular velocity of the horizon, you know, how fast the black hole is really rotating. And if you have the charge, then you have the electrostatic potential, which is the conjugate quantity to charge. And so this would be basically what is the difference between the electrostatic potential at infinity and on the horizon. Okay, so this is, again, if you want an electrostatic potential on the horizon, if I choose that at infinity, it's equal to 0. Okay, so this is the phi, it's the electrostatic potential. And so they show that this must be true. Very good. So now Hawking himself shown another law, which is quite interesting, is that classically, the area of the black hole never decreases. Okay, so that's the second law. And finally, there is the third law, which again, it's not that interesting, but and if you want, it is impossible. It is impossible to reduce kappa to 0 in finite number of steps. So by the way, this thing actually attracted a lot of attention recently, and people are writing hundreds of papers that maybe you can actually do it. But I think it still remains that you cannot do it. So anyway, so we have these four laws, which are proved basically solely on geometrical arguments. But of course, these four laws, they sort of look like the laws of thermodynamics, right? So the question is, if I identify kappa with a temperature, then actually this would be just the laws and the area with the entropy. Then this would be just the laws of thermodynamics, as we know them. Because you know that the first law is that, yeah, we have actually in equilibrium t equals to constant. Then this would just become something like TdS, as you know it from thermodynamics. This is just the entropy never decreases. And that thing is that you cannot achieve t equal to 0 in a finite number of steps, which is the third law. Okay, so the question is, can this be true? And of course, people concluded first that, yeah, this is complete nonsense, because you are saying here that actually for a black hole, this kappa quantity, if it's proportional to temperature, but we have seen that for Schwarzschild black hole, kappa is finite, so the temperature would be finite. So we are saying that black hole would have a finite temperature. But of course, this doesn't make any sense, because in order to have finite temperature, you have to radiate something. Okay, but the black hole classically only absorbs, right? Nothing can escape from the black hole. Rather, the black hole eats everything, and it's an ultimate sponge, and it doesn't, you know, radiate away anything. So that's why people actually rejected that idea. So classically, this cannot happen. Okay, so classically, this is impossible. Impossible. Because black hole is an ultimate sponge. It doesn't radiate anything. It's just, you know, classically, the temperature of the black hole has to be equal to 0. Okay. So t has to be equal to 0. There's no other way. Okay, so this was true, but of course people play with the idea that maybe, you know, there is something to it. Why you would have so many laws which actually go parallel with the laws as you know them. And as I try to motivate, you know, the thermodynamics is very, very general framework, so it should be generally valid to anything, right? So it should be generically applicable. And so so it took actually Bekenstein. So now it doesn't really work. Okay. So part C, black hole thermodynamics. And so it took some time before people actually understood that this is actually nothing else than the laws of black hole thermodynamics. And so the key idea, again, comes from Wheeler, who coined the term black hole. So again, it's a very key figure in black hole physics. So, and so he asked his graduate student, what happens if actually I have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, and I actually throw the coffee inside the black hole. Okay, so what happens? So of course, the cup of coffee had originally some entropy, right? And so now I throw it inside the black hole, but the black hole is at zero temperature. That means there's no entropy. So where actually did the entropy go? What happened? Okay, and so that was the question. It's actually a tea, sorry for that. So we are a cup of tea. So where does the entropy go? If I throw this tea inside the black hole. And so he asked this question, his graduate student Bekenstein. And so Bekenstein answered after some, you know, these thought experiments, you know, what happening with the tea. So Bekenstein is really the key figure, and he said, well, this entropy, which was originally stored in the tea, increases the entropy of the black hole. The black hole doesn't have zero entropy. But this entropy actually has to be proportional to the area of the black hole. That's what he concluded. So as you throw in the tea, then actually the black hole gets bigger, the area increases, and that's why the entropy of the black hole increases. So he concluded that S has to be proportional so that actually the black hole can have entropy, and that this entropy is proportional to the area of the black hole. Okay, so this is what he concluded using, you know, this T idea. Of course, now people say this is stupid. If this is true, then kappa is proportional to T, but it still cannot be so classically because the black hole has zero temperature. And so people didn't believe him at this point. Until Hawking, 1 year later, actually showed that indeed, if you take quantum effects into consideration, then actually black holes have non-trivial temperature. Are there any questions? So I'm telling it like a bedtime story, which I think is fine. I hope you don't fall asleep. Okay, so then Hawking in 74 he actually considered QFT in curve background. QFT in curve background. And of course, I'm not going to do his calculation because this calculation is first very complicated, and second, it's wrong. So anyway, so what he showed that the temperature really that the black hole, if you take quantum effects into account, that the black hole actually radiates away particles, and the temperature, which is given by h bar kappa 2 pi k Boltzmann. And so because he concluded that, and because he knew that by Bekenstein entropy has to be proportional to the area, and he wanted to fix that so that actually this is just the standard first law, then you are just learning that really the entropy is A over 4 or h bar g Newton. Okay, so this was the first derivation of these results. And what it tells you is that really quantum mechanically the black hole radiates away particles. And if you want, well, this is not really true, but if you observed, okay, so it radiates like a black body. Okay, so now this is a little bit problematic because although it radiates black as black body near the horizon, there is some potential which you actually have to cross later on. And so some of the modes, they don't make it, but others they do. So actually, as you go to infinity, this black body actually is becoming gray body. Okay, gray body at infinity. At infinity, because some of the modes actually are scattered back to the black hole, if you want. So anyway, so at infinity, so if you actually neglect this fact that some of the modes actually don't make it, then at infinity you observe this temperature here. Okay. And if you neglect the scattering back, then at infinity you would see like a black body radiation with this temperature here. Okay, so that's what Hawking actually showed. So as I said, people don't believe his derivation. And the derivation, well, why they don't believe it is that, well, talk to Andrew. So Bill Andrew never believed his derivation. And so basically starting from 1974, he criticized it. And he wrote many papers why this cannot be right. And basically the idea is that the modes close to the horizon, actually they are, if you send some modes from infinity to the horizon, then they have infinite blue shift. Okay, so they have infinite energy. But of course, if you have infinite energy, then this infinite energy has to back react on the black hole. So this was like using a test background. So the fields were actually test fields. They didn't modify anything what was happening with the black hole. So you had fixed black hole, and then you studied some fields, quantum fields on this background. But of course, you cannot do that close to the horizon, because close to the horizon, that isn't necessarily a back reaction. Okay, and so these modes have huge energy. That's why the back reaction should be huge. And so that's why you cannot trust actually Hawking's derivation. Okay, so derivation criticized by many people. But what's actually funny is that people were trying to employ different techniques. So for example, you know, using a completely different approach to the calculation of QFT in curved background was this Euclidean path integral. And gives the same result in the leading order. And if you want, loop quantum gravity, where the calculation is completely different, gives you the same result in the leading order. And if you want string theory, if you want in the leading order, gives you the same result as over here. So all these theory, all, you know, all these approaches are completely different approaches, but in the end they give you the same, they give you the same answer, at least in the leading order, as Hawking got. So maybe maybe it's true that all the derivations are actually wrong, but I think it's unlikely because they really use different starting points and they use different things. So maybe actually the result is true. And so moreover, actually, in his pursuit to actually criticize this derivation, Bill Andrew proposed that actually this is a purely kinematic effect, where actually the Einstein equations really don't play any role. And so he was looking at the equations, and he discovered that exactly the same equations you get, for example, for water waves, for surface waves on water. Okay, and so he studied those equations, and he actually said, well, there must be Hawking radiation in surface waves in water as well. And so he proposed an experiment, and he actually measured this Hawking radiation in an analog system. Okay, so there is this thing here. So, well, there's not space here, but it can be shown that Hawking radiation is a kinematic effect, which means that it doesn't really depend on dynamics. It does not require Einstein equations. So all you need to know is that there's some geometry, basically. Okay, so people pursue this idea in the analog systems. And so there is now many experiments, actually. So one of them is, for example, surface waves on water. And so you can observe, you can mathematically show that there should be something like Hawking radiation as well. And so this actually has been now measured. And it's a beautiful tabletop experiment. So people are really playing with their water tank on their table, and they were producing the surface waves. And then they measure, what's happening with the surface waves. And they've seen that actually you can sort of mimic a black hole by modeling what's happening with the bottom of this thing. And then actually you can sort of produce these Hawking radiation. You can produce some small waves actually close to the horizon of this analog black hole. So now this has been measured. Of course, people still argue that this has nothing to do with Hawking radiation because there is no black hole, really. Bill Andrew will tell you that the physics is exactly the same. Okay, so it has been measured. So probably it's correct. Are there any questions here? Okay, so now let me do. The simplest derivation, if you want, of these things. And that's the Euclidean pass integral or Euclidean trick. So as I said, the derivation by Hawking is quite complicated. And so I will not do it here. And the other derivation is also complicated. But this one is actually, you can do it in one blackboard almost. So let's give you the proof of this. So part D will be Euclidean trick. Okay. Yeah?
I just have a question. So if you pour the cup of tea into a black hole,
yeah,
you increase its entropy, and there is this radiation of particles all the time. How does this affect the entropy?
Well, of course, very good. So as you radiate particles away, of course, the black hole is losing energy, right? So because you are radiating away, it's losing the energy, its area has to decrease. Mm-hmm. So quantum mechanically, actually, the area of the black hole decreases, and that's why the entropy also decreases.
So there's no change in entropy when you pour a cup?
No. Okay, so eventually, yeah, it's radiated away again in this black body radiation, if you want. But in the meantime, of course, it increases, and then it's slightly decreases over time. Yeah. So he didn't, really assume that there is like radiation of particles or nothing like that. He was just, asking where did the entropy go? What's happening with that entropy? Okay, so now Euclidean trick, you will see, maybe you have seen already in your QFT course, but if not, you will see it next week or the week after that, is that if you have thermal green functions, So you have seen green functions, which are the, let's say, two-point correlation functions. So if you have Thelma green functions, then you simply change time to imaginary time. And so in this imaginary time, such green functions will be periodic. OK, so Thelma green functions have periodicity in imaginary time. And this comes from, you know, a huge similarity between the path integral and actually the partition function as you know it from statistical physics. So basically, the only thing is that in one, you have to be in Euclidean space. In the other one, you are in the Minkowski space. So now you have to rotate the time to be in the Euclidean space. And that's why you have this imaginary time. So if t is the Minkowski time, then this guy is my imaginary time here. And the statement is that your correlation function or your green function will be periodic in this imaginary time. So g of tau must be equal to g of tau plus some constant. So that's the periodicity. And the statement is that if you find that this is so, then this periodicity is related to your temperature as 1 over t, as you know it. OK? So this is just the statement from QFT2. You will see it in 2 weeks, basically proved. OK? So we have that. We can use this. And so now you can study the fields in the vicinity of the Euclideanized Schwarzschild black hole. So what you take your Schwarzschild black hole, you take the imaginary time or whatever, and then you study the fields in the vicinity of the black hole, and you find, yeah, they actually have periodic Green's functions. And so that means actually they behave like they were in a thermal bath. Okay? So that you can do easily. But let's ask what's happening with the gravitational field. So in particular, consider the gravitational field. And so you'll consider the Euclideanized Schwarzschild metric. Okay, so now, this is simpler than it sounds. You just take your Schwarzschild metric, which is no longer there, and you just go from t to it. You have your tau. So now your metric just looks like ds square Euclidean version is just f d tau square dr square over f r square d omega square. OK, so this is your Euclidean version of the Schwarzschild metric, you just change t to it. Okay. So now the trick is to look at the horizon. And so in particular, to expand what's happening with this function f near the horizon. So near horizon, you can write f of r as f of r plus r minus r plus times f prime at r plus other things. Okay, we are just doing the Taylor expansion around the horizon. But of course, this guy here is 0 because that's how we define r plus, right? So this guy is 0. And so this is just delta r, if I call this delta r, times f prime at r plus. But if you remember the formula for the surface gravity, it was just f prime over 2, right? So that's how you calculate the surface gravity. So this is actually 2 times delta r times kappa, where kappa is the surface gravity on that horizon of the black hole. OK, so now how our metric looks like here, E S squared. So close to the horizon, we have F, which is this thing here, 2 delta R kappa d tau square. And then you have dr square 2 kappa delta R and plus R plus square d omega square. Okay, so this is how your metric now looks in the vicinity of the horizon. Okay, and so now, interesting observation, this thing here, of course, depends only on R. So it is a total differential of something. And let's call that something rho. Okay, so I want to call this d rho square. So in other words, you just introduce new variable by requiring that dr square over 2 kappa delta r is d rho square. In other words, d rho is dr over 2 kappa delta r square root of that. And so this you can integrate, and you can actually write down what rho is. So integrating this thing is r over square root of r. If I integrate it, I get rho here, and I get square root of r here. So I will have that r is actually rho square. So from here, you find that delta r is just kappa over 2 rho square, if you integrate it. Very good. So now we have that thing is just d rho square. But I can also use what I have calculated here and plug it here into delta r. Right? So I know that delta r is just kappa over 2 rho square. And so your Euclidean metric here now becomes just a kappa square. If you plug it in, rho square d tau square plus d rho square plus r plus square d omega square. Okay, so this is what you are getting, how your Euclidean metric looks like. Everybody happy so far? Maybe. All right, so now here comes an interesting argument. So if you look at this metric here, of course, this is just a sphere, right? It's a sphere at a fixed radius r plus. So this is not interesting. What is interesting is this plus that. But now this plus that almost looks like a flat space, two-dimensional flat space, written in polar coordinates. So almost. We are getting something like d s e square equals 2. Now I'll have rho square. If I had something like this, this would just be a 2D space written in polar coordinates. Rho and psi. Okay, so rho would be my radius, and psi would be my angle. Okay, very good. So that actually suggests that I can change variables. I can introduce this new angle psi to be, so psi is just kappa times tau. Okay, and so I just rewrite it in this form. Now the sneaky argument is, well, you know that, well, you can write whatever you want here, but this would be non-singular only if the psi has a periodicity 2 pi, right? If psi has periodicity 2 pi, I have nice plane with the center in the middle. However, if psi is not equal to 2 pi, let's say it's smaller, then actually I have a conical singularity in the origin. But if it's bigger, I have a conical singularity the other way. Okay, so this thing actually is non-singular at rho equal to 0 only if psi has period of 2 pi. Okay, only if this is true, then actually this would be non-singular at rho equals zero. But if you look what rho equals zero means, so rho equals zero means r equals to r plus. If you just change the coordinates as we did over there, so actually you are saying there will be no singularity at r equal to r plus, provided that I identify this angle psi with this period 2 pi. Okay, so in other words, but you know that originally your metric was non-singular in the Minkowski case, in the Schwarzschild case, the true Schwarzschild case. The metric is non-singular on the horizon. The only singularity on the horizon is just the coordinate singularity. There is no true singularity there. So that's why people say, well, there cannot be any true singularity here, neither, even in the Euclidean case. Okay, so this is what we require. Because this is true in the Minkowski case, we require that this is also true in the Euclidean case. And that was the logic behind it. Okay, so now we have that. So we identify psi as psi plus 2 pi, but psi is just kappa times tau. So you are saying, what you are saying, and I always get it backwards. So this is saying that actually the tau is identified as tau plus 2 pi over kappa. Okay, so this requirement means that. In other words, this is only true. You only have a regular solution on the horizon, provided that your periodic time has this periodicity. This is your imaginary time. It has that periodicity. Okay, and so now you look at here, and you say if there is a periodicity of your imaginary time, then it corresponds to a temperature, beta 1 over t. So this is my beta, and this must be equal to 1 over t. So you conclude that there must be a temperature, kappa over 2 pi. Okay, and so you concluded that yeah, indeed, the black hole has a temperature. Because of this Euclidean argument. So now, of course, this kappa, well, this is precisely what we needed, right? So now I'm setting all the constants, like kb equal to 1 and so on. So this really shows that black hole has a temperature. Of course, people don't believe this derivation again, especially, for example, Penrose never believed. So this was the derivation done by Hawking some years later. But there was this famous discussion between Penrose and Hawking in the style, like in the 30s, you had the discussion between Bohr and Einstein, Bohr pushing for quantum mechanics, and Einstein saying this is all nonsense, physics should be deterministic, right? So Einstein in the end lost. So in this way, there was a similar discussion between Hawking and Penrose. Penrose saying this is all nonsense, conservative, there is no temperature. And Hawking saying, yeah, this is actually true. So I don't know who won, but anyway, so this is the derivation presented by Hawking. The simplest derivation that black holes have temperature. So interestingly, you can push this even further. And so let me just give you an idea, oh no, what's happening there. So I have to tell you how the geometry looks like. Okay, so how does this Euclidean geometry look like? Okay, and so if you look at that ds e square, then you have that sphere, but you have also this polar coordinates here. So you have this thing here, which is just the polar coordinates in psi and rho. But if you translate it back into tau and r, then you get a cigar. So we get a cigar. And so how does it look like is this thing here. So now we live on the surface of that cigar. This thing here corresponds to r equals to r plus. And it's non-singular. It's just, you know, the vicinity here just looks flat. And so each point on that surface of the cigar, there is just a sphere sitting there. So you have a sphere, which is there, and then you have
one thing, which is the radius rho, so radius r, or radius rho, which is going this way. And then you have the other direction, which is the tau direction, and that's identified as period beta. So this is the tau, goes around,
is the period beta. So you can do it everywhere.
Okay, so this is the time as it goes. And then you have the radius, which goes like this, like that.
And so radius goes this way, and the tau goes this way. And then at every point on that surface, there is a sphere sitting there. So this is how this geometry looks like in the Euclidean case. Do you have a question? Okay, so this is what the geometry is. And now you may attempt to calculate what is the partition function for quantum gravity. Okay, so now partition function so we now know from our course that the partition function can be written as the path integral now over the fields. Now the fields is the matrix. So we have the path integral over the matrix. And then you take some action. This action, of course, is the Euclidean action for our gravitational field. And so this is what it must look like. And we also know that in the WKB approximation, it's the stationary point of this action, which actually tells you what it is. And it's just given by e to minus SE of the stationary point of the action, but the stationary point corresponds to classical solutions. So G, classical. So this is the first approximation to your quantum gravity, which people have here, right? So this is in the WKB or geometric optics approximation. Okay. So now this is nice. It must be so. So now, what is the gravitational action for the metric, right? So the gravitational action, the Euclidean action for gravity. So people definitely know that there is something like Einstein-Hilbert action, right? So that's the simplest thing you can write down for Einstein if you want to derive Einstein's theory, is that you integrate over the manifold and d4x square root of minus g. And then there's this 16 pi g. And so the simplest thing you can integrate, which tells you something about the geometry, is the Ricci scale r. So you need to integrate over some scalar. And so the Ricci scale is the simplest possible scalar. If you vary this action with respect to the metric, you get Einstein equations. OK, so this is the Einstein-Hilbert action. Einstein-Hilbert. So in fact, actually, it was Hilbert who came up with this action first and who actually derived the Einstein equations first correctly. So it's like the Einstein was giving a seminar at Hilbert's place, and he told him all about the physics, and then he left. And then Hilbert immediately wrote down the simplest possible action and derived the Einstein equations. And it took Einstein another couple of months to actually arrive at the Einstein equations correctly. Okay. So, but their approach was completely different. So whereas Hilbert's approach was, well, mathematic approach, this is the only thing I can write down, the simplest thing I can write down. And that's why it was easy for him. Einstein actually had the physics inside. And so he was trying to motivate the Einstein equations from the physics inside. So OK, anyway, so that's the history. So now, interestingly, if you write down this Einstein-Hilbert action, then the variational principle is not well posed. And the reason is that if this guy has a boundary, then on the boundary, typically you require that delta of g is equal to 0. Right? So in the same way as in classical mechanics, you require that you have fixed endpoints. You require that delta q is equal to 0 at fixed point here and at fixed point there. But this is not enough. And so this thing actually requires that also delta of the derivative of g on the boundary is equal to 0. So this is on d omega. And so So in order, you know, so you would have to impose these things. So it's like imposing delta Q here and there is equal to zero, but also delta Q dot is zero and there. And then as we discussed in classical mechanics, this is not well posed, and actually it kills any solutions. Okay, so then what people have to do in order to have this variational principle well posed is that you have to add the boundary term, which actually kills these terms here. Okay, so that boundary term is just now you integrate over the boundary d3x. Now this is the boundary metric h mu nu, and then this is something which is called extrinsic curvature, doesn't matter. So now this thing here makes the variational principle well defined. It's called Gibbons Hawking term. Hawking term, and actually makes the variational principle well defined. Okay, so this is all very nice. However, you see that here, in order to calculate the partition function, you actually need the actual value of the action, right? So to having this would be perfectly well, would be perfectly fine if you just wanted to derive the Einstein equations and have your problem well posed. However, if you want the actual value of the action, then you may be asking what these two terms actually give you for the actual value of the action, and they give you infinity. Okay, so that's not very nice. You don't want infinity, even for flat space. So this is not good, and so that's why people add another boundary term to tune the value of the action. And so that's hiding in this K0. So people say, well, I can actually do something magic, which I call this K0, and I define this K0 so that my value of the action is whatever I want. And in particular, that in flat space, actually, it vanishes. Okay, so this is to tune value of SE. In particular, you know, this is guided by the principle that SE should be. To tune the value of S. All right, so we have these three terms for the Euclidean action. And so all you have to do is actually, you know, calculate what these three terms actually give you for our given Schwarzschild Euclidean metric. Right, so now this is just, you know, you use Maple or Mathematica, plug in your metric and calculate what this is, calculate what that is, calculate what that is for your cigar. So what I'm doing here is that this is my Euclidean geometry, this is my R coordinate, and I am regularizing this by saying, well, I integrate all the way to R equals to some big R. So now this is my boundary of that metric, that's my d omega here. And then I calculate this integral here, and then I subtract the corresponding integral with K0. And so what you find out here in this geometric optics approximation is that if you do this, then you find that SE for Schwarzschild Euclideanized Schwarzschild, you find very, very simple result, and that is equal to beta M over 2. Okay, so this is what you find when you actually calculate these horrible three terms. So now, you know, it cannot be anything else, right? So you are integrating over d4x, one of these. Okay, so here you are integrating over d4x, but you know that Schwarzschild is a solution of vacuum Einstein equations. So this guy doesn't contribute because r mu nu is equal to zero, which means r is equal to zero. So this guy doesn't contribute. So the only things which can contribute are these things. So now this is designed in such a way that for flat space, I'm getting zero. So I'm subtracting anything which, you know, is infinite of anything which is bad. And so I can only get, in the end, something which is proportional to M, to really the fact that I have a black hole there. Okay. And moreover, this d3x integral, it also includes the integral over the time. But time is proportional to beta. So if you integrate over the time, it has period beta. So the integral over the time has to give you beta. Okay, so that's why this is the result. So it must be proportional to m, beta, and the non-trivial result of the calculation is 1/2. Okay, so that's what you are getting here. And so now you apply the statistical physics machinery, and you say, well, my free energy is minus t times logarithm of the partition function. So now our partition function z is e to minus beta m over 2. So this is what we found. And now you have minus t logarithm of z, which is nothing else than m over 2. So that's your free energy. Having the free energy, you can calculate, for example, the entropy. So the entropy is just minus df over dt. I remind you that we have that the t is, well, we derived it before, that t is 1 over 8 pi m. So this is what we had. So now, if you write down m in terms of t, so m goes like 1 over t. So if you differentiate m over t, you get 1 over t squared. Okay, so this is 1 over 16 pi t squared. And if you write it in terms of the radius, it's pr plus square, which is the area over 4. So in other words, actually, using this partition function calculation, you can really prove that also the entropy has to be A over 4. Not only that the temperature is that, but the entropy is actually as you would expect. You are proving the Bekenstein's relation here, just using the statistical physics machinery. So this is the Bekenstein result. Isn't this beautiful? So of course, it's all cheating, right? But anyway, it gives the right results. So this is what Hawking is actually saying, with the simplest derivation, that the black holes have entropy and they have temperature as this Euclidean path integral derivation. Question? Yeah?
So when we integrated over all space there, do we not just integrate over all of the space outside the horizon?
Oh, very good. So you are integrating over, this is a very good question. So we are integrating over the Euclidean geometry, right? But the Euclidean geometry has nothing inside the horizon. The Euclidean geometry looks like this cigar. So basically, you cut the geometry at r equal to r plus, where you make it nice and smooth. And whatever was inside the horizon sort of disappears. So here, you are integrating over outside, what's happening outside of the horizon, because that's your full manifold. You cannot actually extend that manifold through that horizon here.
Then could you consider the horizon as another boundary, and then
look back at
another boundary?
Well, if you did the calculation in the Minkowski version, then yes. Then you would say, well, I have one boundary at infinity, another boundary on the horizon, and yeah, you would integrate in between. Here, you don't need to do that because there is no boundary. There's everything is nice on the horizon. But it's a very good question. And yeah, other questions?
How can we choose the value of k naught?
How can we be sure?
Choose, I mean.
K naught. I didn't explain anything. So I'm just saying, you know, people basically design this k0 so that this gives you whatever the value you want. But there's a guiding principle that you say, I want actually that for vacuum solutions, the first term is gone. And I want the second term gives you infinity. So I want to exactly cancel that infinity so that I get zero. So it's natural to have for vacuum solutions the value of the action to be zero. right? Because it's like a ground state, right? So really you tune that K0. So what it really is that what you are doing is this thing here. So this is your true geometry, which gives you the K, but then you subtract the corresponding geometry, which has nothing inside here. So this is the flat metric, flat thing, with the same periodicity. So tau plus beta, but however, there is now no black hole. So this is what you do. This gives you K0, and this gives you precisely what I was saying, M over 2 beta. Okay, so this is what you are doing there. There is much more rigorous way how to do this, because you have the boundary. You can actually think about the stress energy tensor on the boundary. And you know that you can actually tune, so you know that during the renormalization you will generate some counter terms or some extra terms. And so people can actually formulate this very geometrically. So what you need to add to get a finite volume is that you are adding some counter terms as you would get in renormalization procedure. So this can be done much more rigorously if you want. But for this calculation, it doesn't matter, it gives the same result. Okay, I have 5 minutes. So I wanted to say one more thing, and that's actually the black holes can have interesting phase transitions. Okay, so black holes. Holes can have interesting phase transitions, thermodynamic phase transitions. So that was the key feature of our course. And so let's have a look at that. And so we know, so we can just do the thermodynamics here. So typically what you do is that you say, well, free energy is the energy minus TS. The energy we land is just the mass of the black hole. So this is just M minus TS. So now, basically, to calculate the phase transitions in black hole spacetimes, all you have to do is to study this free energy, where this is the mass of the black hole, this is the temperature, and this is the entropy. Okay, so you are asking what this free energy is actually doing. Okay, and if this free energy is doing something bad, then you know there will be a phase transition. All right, so let's look at that free energy. For some black holes. All right, so now the first thing you can look at is the Schwarzschild black hole. So now this free energy, of course, is a function of temperature and other things. So the free energy is a function of temperature and other parameters in your black hole. So for example, the charge, if it's a charged black hole, cosmological constant, if it's a black hole in ADS and whatever. Okay, so now it's natural to plot the free energy with respect to the temperature. And so you may be asking, is this free energy doing something bad? So now, if you do this for Schwarzschild black hole, you just get a boring graph like this. So this is boring. So now, what is each point on this curve is basically a different size of the black hole. So you start with the large black holes. Large black holes here, and you have small black holes here. So the R plus increases like that, if you want, of the black hole. And for each R plus, I will have the corresponding temperature here. So this is my free energy, but this is really boring. So there's no phase transitions here. Okay, what you can also show, well, okay. So this is the free energy of Schwarzschild black hole. So now, in your tutorial today, you will look at something more interesting, which is the Schwarzschild black hole plus charge. So now you have charged black hole. The free energy looks slightly nicer. So the free energy actually looks like something like this. So it is it is smooth everywhere, but there is this one cusp here where, you know, something interesting happens. So this would be for charged black hole. But this is still not very interesting. But what is interesting is once you go to ADS. Okay, so in ADS, so Schwarzschild ADS, Schwarzschild plus lambda, which is negative. So your metric just looks like 1 minus 2m over r plus r square over l square, where l is the radius corresponding to the cosmological constant. So lambda is proportional to 1 minus l square. So lambda is negative. You are in cosmological setting with negative cosmological constant, which is characterized by some length scale l. And so it's spherically symmetric spacetime with this metric function f. Okay, and so now if you plot the free energy, what you find is this thing here. So this is t, and this is f. And you find a diagram like this. Again, each point here corresponds to different radius. So the radius increases like that. Okay. So you have a small black hole here, and then you have a large black hole here. Okay. So now you see that, yeah, again, you get some cusp here. And if for so that is like, so for this range of temperatures, there is no black hole. And then above the temperature, you actually have two black holes possible. So for a given temperature, you have black hole here and black hole there. So you have either small black hole or large black hole. But of course, thermodynamically, the one which has the lower free energy is preferred, right? So actually, this one, this thing here, is thermodynamically preferred because they have lower free energy than the upper one. So large black holes are preferred. So now this is all very nice, but you haven't taken into account the Hawking radiation. You know that there is a Hawking radiation everywhere around you. So there is a radiation filling your space-time. So your the true thing is actually space-time. So the space-time, the whole system is black hole plus radiation. Okay. So here, this free energy only describes the free energy of the black hole. But if you actually plot a free energy of the radiation, and then you can, of course, play with the units, but it's basically like that. This is the free energy of radiation. So this is radiation. And now you see a beautiful thing. You want to minimize the free energy always. So you see that up to here is the radiation, which has smaller free energy. But starting from here, it's the black hole, which has the lower free energy. So here, you expect that it's a phase transition. This is called Hawking Page phase transition. So this is a corresponding T Hawking Page. And so at this temperature, there will be a phase transition from radiation to black hole. Okay, so radiation to large black hole phase transition. And so this, when they published the paper, nobody cared, right? But now people in ADS are mad about it because of the ADS CFT correspondence, and they say, well, there must be a corresponding phase transition happening on the CFT side. And actually, Witten came and wrote this paper. It actually corresponds to quark-gluon phase, the confinement-deconfinement phase transition for quark-gluon plasma. Okay, so that would be like a dual interpretation. So through ADS CFT, CFT is like the confinement of quarks. So now, after the ADS CFT actually took over, this paper got thousands of sites and stuff like that. So they said, yeah? No? So let me stop here. So there's this really, you know, interesting phase transitions you can have in black holes. And whenever you go to a string theory talk or whatever, it's, I think, 50% chance that you will hear about Hawking phase transition, which is a transition from radiation to large black hole. OK, so now you know everything about it. OK, so that concludes the course. So thank you so much. And see you in the afternoon if you are interested in a tutorial on these things. Thank you.